Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Are French kids really better eaters? Are they more polite and less demanding? Do Japanese children regulate their own playground tiffs? American parents seem to have a gnawing sense of inferiority and are looking all over the world for just the perfect approach to child rearing. What can we learn from other cultures when it comes to parenting? Or are American parents doing fine and are just insecure? We'll talk about parenting and parenting advice on today's show with two writers and moms. Mayling Hopgood has written How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm, which takes a look at parenting approaches from around the world. She's also an associate professor of journalism at Northwestern University. Mayling, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning.
And journalist Bridget Schulte has written about parenting and women's struggles to juggle careers and kids. Schulte has been a staff writer for The Washington Post since 1999. She's currently on leave and is a fellow at the New America Foundation and is writing a book. Bridget, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I guess before we talk about parenting advice, I think it would be good to put our cards on the table. Bridget, how does what role does parenting advice play in your life as a mother?
Well, you know, it's funny. When I had my first son, I was probably like every other mother, you know. First of all, I lived far away from my own mother, my own family, so I didn't have kind of that built-in extended family where you do learn a lot in the past. That's sort of where knowledge has been passed down. So what did I do? I went to the bookstore. What did I find? 25 different books telling me to do 25 different things. So what did I do? I sort of closed my eyes and picked one and tried to follow it. And It was a method to try to get your baby to sleep, and for some reason you had to nurse them but then not let them fall asleep right afterward. And so I remember I was very serious when my mother came to visit. No, you can't let him sleep after he nurses. And she was trying really hard and singing to him and jostling him. And it struck me how crazy that was. This child wanted to sleep. Why was I being so kind of religiously fervent about not letting him sleep so that he would sleep through the night, which he wasn't anyway? And so I went down the path of the expert, certainly first, and I bought into all the 0 to 3, oh my goodness, his neurons are dying if I don't stimulate them, and I got baby Einstein, and I, you know, got all the black and white mobiles. I went nuts. And I think it's, my kids are a lot older now, and I think it's through a process of trial and error and failure and trying one thing and finally just realizing, you know, just spend time with your kids, get to know your kids, relax.
And Mayling, what about you? Did you use parenting advice books when you first became mother, or maybe still do now?
Yes, I mean, when I was pregnant, I remember going nuts looking up on the internet, you know, which stroller I was going to buy, doing the research, you know, making sure that I was going to get the right city stroller versus a travel system. I was doing research, and I was abroad. I was living in Argentina. So I had this strange mix of I was using the internet and parenting books on one hand, but I was limited in what I could get there. At the time, the Kindles weren't as big, and we certainly didn't have them in Argentina, so access to English books were limited. So I was looking on the internet and still doing a lot of research that way. But on the other hand, I had this whole other experience of being in a culture that didn't so much obsess over parenting advice from books and the internet. And it was sort of a more natural kind of go with it attitude that people had around me. So I had these polar forces influencing what I was thinking about at the time. So yes, I definitely used parenting advice, but I also had was surrounded by people who didn't so much.
And Bridget, do you think that is an American thing, that American parents look so much to parenting advice books, or is that the same in any other country as well?
Well, truthfully, it's really become an American thing. And I think for a variety of different reasons, and some of them, like I'd mentioned before, we really don't live close to our mothers and our grandmothers and our aunts and our uncles anymore. We're, you know, we're very atomized. We're very isolated in a sense. And so what we look to now are, you know, the experts in the books or the blogs. There's so much out there on the blogosphere that would actually make you crazy if you listen to it. It actually can become very vicious, and you must, you know, do this, or you must attachment parent. No, if you don't attachment parent and wear your child for 2 years, then you're abandonment parenting. And there's a lot of judgment and a lot of viciousness. The writer Eilert Wildman calls them the bad mother police. You know that they're everywhere.
And Bridget, what struck you about our current fascination with foreign parenting books that may have been written by Americans but talk about a parenting approach from another country?
Well, again, it goes back to the sense of this is a very highly achievement-oriented culture. It's also a very highly individualistic culture. When you are an achievement culture, you are an information maximizer. You want to look everywhere because you want to do the absolute best thing. And so you have to scan widely. You look to see who's doing it better. And there's nothing that sets an American parent off more than seeing those international test scores where the United States comes somewhere in the middle, and that sets off a wave of panic without recognizing really what those test scores are showing, that we have a vastly diverse country with all sorts of kids at different levels, and they are all included in those test scores. Whereas, say, in China, where you've got really high-scoring kids, they only include Shanghai, where people are very well-educated and fairly well-off. So people don't understand sort of the nuances that come out in those test scores, and they go crazy.
So it is a sense of insecurity that we're not doing good enough. We're doing something wrong.
There is that sense of we want to be the best, and we're not sure what that is. It does breed insecurity, yes.
And Mei Ling, you mentioned you lived in Argentina when you first became a mother. Is that what drew you to foreign parenting? And I don't want to call it advice, because your book is not an advice book, but it talks about what parents in other cultures do. And is that where you became interested, or was it also your own multicultural background?
It was a combination of both, although I have to say, before thinking about being a parent, I didn't really think much about the things I was seeing in terms of how my biological parents in Taiwan did things, how many of the parents around me when I was traveling for work were doing things. I didn't really think so much about it. I observed it, thought it was amusing and interesting, but didn't think about it. It took being a parent to start thinking about it. And yes, it was definitely, you know, I'm pregnant and I'm thinking about how the Argentine families around me are letting their kids stay up so late and out at restaurants till midnight, you know, toddlers, babies, teenagers on up. And it was those kind of things, plus the way they treat pregnant women differently and how men are much more intimate with babies in public. Strangers will touch your baby and do different things like that really made me think about this issue and really interested me, because it really started to challenge my own ideas about what I think about parenting and my own values and how I was going to raise a child in a foreign place, yet incorporate my American background.
And you describe in the book how you and your husband took your daughter out, went to restaurants, kind of rolled with what was going on all around you. So when you returned to the United States with your child, who was now being used to going out till whatever, 11 o'clock at night, how different were you from other parents around you?
I still feel, you know, we just moved back about a month, 2 months ago, and mm-hmm. I'm still in sort of a culture shock that way. I mean, we definitely didn't keep her out and late every night, but we always felt like there was exceptions. She would be accepted in late night social settings. Here, you know, we're more isolated, of course. We know less people. It's a different culture. It's a little bit, we talked about earlier, it is more independent, you know, people are more distant from each other. Definitely we're going to bed earlier, certainly. And they're waking up earlier, which is another great change. But
and you talk about in the book as well, you mention how the culture in Argentina just seems more welcoming of doing things together as a family. So the kids are there, the adults are there. So it's not like we have separate social lives, which we seem to have in this country, where our kids do play dates and we do play dates with our friends.
Right, right. It is very much the line between adult time and children time is very much blurred. And it's also expected at, for example, family dinners that will run because they start dinner at 10 o'clock, especially on weekends, especially during the summer. If the family's all getting together, of course the children are going to be there, and they're going to be playing, and they're going to be tired, and they're going to be eating with them at 10 and 11 o'clock. I mean, that's just, it's a no-brainer. The kids are supposed to be with you during those times. I mean, that's just a cultural expectation.
And that's so interesting. Could I interject something?
Sure, please do.
You know, you talk about how in Argentina it's very family-centered. And I would argue here in the United States, it's not so much that it's not family-centered, but it's really more child-centered here. Because I've been looking at time use studies, and that's what's so fascinating and actually unbelievable. When you look at the United States, when I was talking about some of the things that have changed structurally, you've got to look at we have more full-time working mothers in the United States than any other country in the planet. And at the same time, we have none of the structural supports. We have no paid parental leave. We're one of three countries, three industrialized countries, that have no paid parental leave, including Swaziland and Papua New Guinea. We have no easy access. We have no federal child care policy. Nixon vetoed that in the early 1970s, saying that it was too Soviet. So we've kind of got this system where we've kind of set up this it's almost like a no exit, no win kind of thing. And so kind of what we've ended up doing is there's also been at the same time this intensification of what we expect from parents, particularly mothers. And think about it in the 1960s, you know, the mom would be sitting there playing bridge, drinking coffee, go out and play till the streetlights come on. Now what the time use studies are showing is that even working mothers spend more time with their children than stay-at-home moms did in the 1960s. And it's taken me a while to get my head wrapped around that, but when you look at where that time came from, that came from sleep, from house care, and personal leisure. And so what you find is that in the United States, most families do spend their free time with their kids, but it's on the sidelines of the soccer game. It's schlepping them around to all sorts of different activities. It's part of that helicopter hyper-parenting, again, because we're so afraid that they're going to fall behind and we want to be this achievement culture.
But even though we do all that, Bridget, it feels a lot of parents have that sense that it's never enough. They don't spend enough time with their kids. They are not doing enough at work. So there's also that sense of guilt.
Absolutely. And that's what's so interesting is that really when you look at just about any survey or any poll, women have long felt that they don't do enough at work and they don't do enough at home. And so they're sort of guilt-ridden, is kind of soaked in this horrible sense of guilt and never enough. And what's interesting is that some of the studies are now showing that fathers who have a more progressive attitude and want to be more involved with their children are beginning to feel that very same sense of time pressure and inadequacy.
We have a break coming up. Mei-Ling, hold that thought. We have a break coming up. We'll talk more after a moment. We're talking about parenting with journalist Bridget Schulte and with author Mei-Ling Hopgood. Her new book is How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Maybe you found some useful parenting advice out there, something that really helped you, or maybe something that really confused you. Give us a call and join the conversation here on Radio Times.
The National Museum of American Jewish History supports WHYY and presents Mayim Bialik. Following a panel discussion about bat mitzvah and coming of age in America, Mayim, best known for her current role on The Big Bang Theory and the 90s sitcom Blossom, will share her coming of age experiences as a young Jewish woman on and off set, discuss her endeavors in the academic and entertainment worlds, and explore how her background influences her work. Sunday, March 25th at 2 p.m., nmajh.org or 215-923-3811.
Next week, it's special coverage from NPR News. The U.S. Supreme Court considers the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. It's one of the most important legal and policy cases of our generation. I'm Jennifer Ludden. Join me for a daily recap of each day's arguments. That's special coverage from NPR News, The Supreme Court Debates Healthcare.
Coverage begins Monday night at 8 on WHYY.
The First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia at 21st and Walnut supports WHYY. First Pres has demonstrated a commitment to the city through volunteer efforts and inclusive community service, welcoming all. Concerts, including chamber music, organ recitals, and choral performances, are offered to the congregation and community throughout the year. Information about the First Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia is available at fpcphila.org or 215-567-0532.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about parenting and parenting advice on today's show with two writers and moms. Mayling Hopgood has written How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm, and journalist Bridget Schulte has written about parenting and women's struggles to juggle careers and kids. And before our break, we were talking about the structure and culture that is in place around a parenting approach. And I'm wondering, Mayling, maybe you can weigh in on this. When we look longingly at what women are seemingly doing better in France or anywhere else in the world, do we forget sometimes that there is a whole structure around that? So maybe we can't just take the approach and pluck it and put it in place over here?
Oh, sure. You know, there's no... Parenting practices evolve for a reason over time. There's a certain values, certain environmental issues, etc., contribute to how people parent and what they view as right. What I wanted to bring up and to just to add was that it is true that many of the parents that I spoke to in different places, such as in China, where I wrote about how parents potty train their children earlier than we do, many times right after they begin to walk. Or in France, I wrote about how children, parents sort of integrate their children into their eating early, in that they want them to eat what they eat. They embrace mealtime together. They value food, and thus the children take on the attitude that the parents do. And even in Argentina, like I was talking about earlier, this is sort of viewed as just part of the natural, what quote-unquote is natural in parenting. There's no, for example, in China, the parents that I talked to were just befuddled or really confused about why I would want to write about something like potty training when it's so natural and it's not a big deal and it's not something that you needed to put a goal on. It was just something they did. I would talk to my friends in Argentina about my child and how she's not sleeping and how she still wants to sleep in bed with us, etc., the moms, we'd all share this these anecdotes and complain and just lament not getting sleep, but there wasn't the sense of, oh my gosh, I have to solve it. Mm-hmm. I have to do the perfect thing to make it right. I was feeling guilty myself about not doing the right thing to get her to sleep right. But I remember my friends looking at me like I was crazy when I was like, oh, what do I do? They're like, this is just part of parenthood. It's going to pass. That was the quote. It's going to pass. And I thought it was funny because I mean, imagine, you know, I bring it up to my American friends and we're all trying to solve it. What do? Will you, like, exactly, you know, do you nurse and take away, you know, put her to bed before she sleeps? Do you sleep train her? What do you do? When in Argentina, my friends were like, oh, it's just, you know, it'll pass. And I just thought it was really just a stark difference between how we view the quote-unquote problems of parenthood versus how many of the parents that I spoke to view them.
And I want to, in a moment, get to the potty training chapter you write about in the book, because you actually tried that. You tried this at home, what you learned in China. But Bridget, one of the books that has been so appealing to American audiences lately is Bringing Up Bebe, which mm-hmm. is about an American woman's experience in France. And one of the review articles that I read actually said she's looking at French mothers with beer goggles on, basically, saying that it just looks, everything looks rosy and wonderful, but she's just looking at it longingly from the outside, but not really getting a sense of life in that culture. Is it that maybe to us looking in from the outside, it just seems like French women have it all and can and manage to have it all?
Well, French women don't have it all, actually. Now, I thought that I thought it was a great book, and I thought she brought up some really great points. You know, in France, the structure there is fabulous for a working mother. I spoke with a woman who is an economist at the Sorbonne. She's 60, and her mother was a lawyer. So we're talking about a long, long history of women working and doing very high-level things. And one of the things she said is, you know, we don't have any guilt. Of course women work. But the interesting thing is women work and combine work and family through these great programs they have. Absolutely, you know, universal access to childcare. You know, Pamela Druckerman took her kids to this beautiful, you know, childcare center, which she said she was expecting the DMV, you know, something scary and governmental. And she said she found Canyon Ranch. Well, that's all subsidized by the government. After that, when their children were three, they go to the, you know, to school, this beautiful preschool. And France does have the highest rate of 3 and 4 year olds in school. So, you know, that's another wonderful thing. In France, you are actually paid. You get a subsidy for each additional child that you have because they want to encourage the fertility rates. They want to encourage childbirth. You get to deduct the cost of your maid because they want to make it easier for you to work and have a family. But at the same time, it's a highly sexist culture. When I look at the Time Use studies, you know, it's almost like the state and mothers are raising their children. And, I, you know, this is unfair because there's always outliers. But on average, it looks like French fathers hardly ever see their children at all, you know. So there are some absolutely wonderful things about the French system. The other thing that she talks about is that there's this sort of cadre, and I think Maylin was talking about this sense, this cultural sense that you raised your children in one way and everybody did the same thing. So you don't have these, you know, cacophony of different voices like you do in the United States and this sort of, oh, you have to do this. No, do this. And so I think that gives you a sense of calmness that we don't really have here. So yeah, I think there are some great things about the French culture, but you also have to look structurally. It's entirely different than what we have here.
And women have a lot more resources and parents, I guess. Parents have a lot more resources to do the job.
Because of the state. The mm-hmm. state's helping them out in a way that in the United States we view raising a child. They view that, and this is what's important when you look at some of the very family-friendly policies in Europe and Northern Europe particularly. Their philosophy is that the entire society is responsible for raising the next generation. That influences their policies. In the United States, we view children as an individual responsibility. If you're going to have children, it's up to you to pay for them. You figure out your child care situation. We don't want to hear about it. It's a very different culture.
Let's get a caller in. Oh, sorry, Mei-Ling.
Wanted to add on to something Bridget said. And also, the whole obsession, I mean, it's not necessarily these books that are not, I think Bringing Up Bebe and Tiger Mom, they were interesting. They were very, they taught us something. But it's what bothers me is the discourse around those books. We put headlines on them saying French parents are superior, Chinese parents are superior, when that's a ridiculous statement. I mean, it's very pat. We can learn from the way people in other places do things. We can take tidbits, we can reject them, the ideas, but we don't have to say somebody is superior and someone is not. And that's part of the discourse. It's that whole guilt. We have to be competitive. We have to be the best. I mean, I think that's very destructive in the whole discourse on parenting.
And you see that play out. You see that play out on any playground too, where it seems to me that a lot of parents congregate toward other parents that do things the same way they do. So you kind of check out, how is she handling this? And then you see playground alliances form in a way where people stick to each other. Do you see that happening, Bridget?
Well, my kids are older now. My son is 13 and my daughter is 10. And I think when they get a little older, some of that competition, some of that sort of falls away and you become a little bit more confident in your own parenting. Because again, I think there's a wonderful book, Raising Happiness by Christine Carter. She's a sociologist out at Berkeley. And her whole philosophy is you raise for happiness. And you're not talking about something soft and silly like, oh, my child will be happy if I let him play video games all day. It's not that kind of easy pleasure of happiness, but a really authentic sense of who is my child? What is it that he or she needs? How can I push? How can I pull back? How can I be really in tune to them and spend quality time that isn't screaming on the sidelines of the soccer game, that isn't ferrying them around from one activity to, you know, more, Mandarin today and French lessons tomorrow and petite ballet the next day? You know, what is it that will make my child happy? Because there's really interesting studies that, again, being this achievement culture, there were these psychologists, they reviewed about 225 different studies about happiness, well-being, and achievement. And what they found was that if you were happy first, the achievement followed.
Mm. Let's get a call in. We have Bill joining us from Belmont at 1-888-477-9499. Hi, Bill. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I'm in Belmont Hills in Lower Merion, which is an excellent school district, and I wanted to say that I've raised two girls, they're women now, they're in their 30s, and then I have a 14-year-old who's finishing middle school. So I've had a lot of parenting experience, especially in the suburban environment, and so many of us, including myself, put huge pressure on our kids. And I think as a result, we have a huge increase in mental health issues with these kids, from a young age all the way through college. And it's just ridiculous. And I think that, especially in a recession where kids leave tough schools and end up getting no jobs or menial jobs, the other thing is I think it's terribly self-indulgent of us. If we're middle class or upper middle class, if we get our kids interested in learning, the kids will end up all right. It's really the kids in the inner cities who are having trouble. And for us to be overly neurotic and overly focused on these kind of issues is just sheer self-indulgence.
Thank you so much, Bill. I'm going to say goodbye to you just because we have a bad line, but I appreciate the comment. And Mei-Ling, the anxiety that parents feel has come up a lot. And you've said earlier that's something you didn't see present as much in Argentina, for example. Do you feel that now that you're back here? It's a more anxious culture?
I definitely do, but I don't know if it's me or the people around me. You know, it's just and I'm in a situation too where I'm coming back into my own culture after being out of it for more than 7 years with kids. I have to choose the right preschool, you know, what activities do we do, meeting new friends, etc. So I'm in kind of an odd situation, but definitely you can feel it in how people talk about schools and when they talk to me about preschool, when they talk to me about the activities, etc. And, you know, as I'm trying to keep that voice inside my head at a low level.
And Bridget, what do you hear from women who try not to get involved in all that and who are trying to be less anxious? They sometimes get a bad rap and other parents look at them like they're not doing their job.
That's really true. I think the caller brought up some really good points, though, about the sense of our own insecurity pressing our kids and then leading to some mental health issues. There's some really disturbing studies that have come out that find that, you know, as much as a quarter of kids in these Ivy League and high prestige schools, they're on medication for depression and anxiety. So you really do have to ask, what are we doing to our kids? What do we value?
And Bridget, do you think, is this a middle and upper class thing, or do you see this parental angst cut through all socioeconomic backgrounds?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I've asked that question because it certainly is painted as a middle and upper middle class issue. And when I've talked to different sociologists who look at this, and there are different points of view. There are some who say it's very middle class, and there's more of a sense of, you know, let the kids grow in more of a lower socioeconomic level. But what all of them will say really is the middle and upper middle class set the culture. So if they set the tone, then what tends to filter down is the expectation that that's the best thing to do. So then what you have is not only guilt, but a sense of hopelessness if you don't have the resources in terms of time or money to do what everybody else is doing.
Let's get another caller in at 1-888-477-9499. Also, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We have Tom joining us from Philadelphia. Hi, Tom. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. So when I was in graduate school in history, I was studying David McClellan, who was the
head of Harvard's psychology department in the 50s and 60s, and he had generated this whole theory of why civilizations collapsed based on parenting, basically. Everything was associated with what he called achievement motivation. And when I studied it, I looked at it critically as, you know, an example of the overreach of social science. And then I became a parent, and as my son grew older, I found myself totally unable not to apply this theory that I didn't believe in to my own parenting. And I still can't, you know, I still worry about my son's achievement motivation.
How did you apply the theory?
I don't know what it is.
How did you, Tom, how did you apply this theory in your parenting?
Well, I try not to, actually. You know, the theory was that he did these wonderful studies where you have kids toss bean bags into buckets, and if they stood too close, they had low achievement motivation. Anyway, and so I watch my son play games and worry that he wasn't trying hard enough or was trying to do things that were too easy for him. I try not to, you know, apply any of these things to my own parenting, but it's hard not to. You learn about a new theory that explains everything, and it's hard not to look at yourself through that lens.
And Tom, were you surprised at your own parental anxiety as you became a parent?
Yes, very, very much so. I thought I was somehow inoculated from it due to my research, but no.
Thank you so much, Tom, for that call.
I wanted to add one thing, that what's interesting is this anxiety or our sort of obsession with parenting advice is actually filtering into the rest of the world, like everything else that comes from, you know, the West. Parenting books, the internet, etc., it is getting to places that didn't have these sort of, you know, that went by what mom and grandmother said. People have, like in Argentina, Duérmete Niño is the Ferberizing method, and that is very much, it has begun to start, you know, to be circulated. And in China, you know, diapers are it's the largest market in the world for diapers. And so it's changing the way that parents are parenting. And it's very interesting to look at how this sort of our anxiety or our our conveniences and products, et cetera, are reaching places all over the world.
And Mei Ling, I was thinking of the issue when you were talking about how our anxieties go around the world. I was thinking about the issue of co-sleeping, which in this country is a very anxiety-producing topic. And in other cultures, reading your book and talking to friends around the world, that topic is never discussed. It's like, of course the baby sleeps in your bed.
Yes, I mean, there's no doubt that most cultures, in fact, sleep with their children, at least to their one, if not older, and think nothing of it. And that's just, it's, and there's no sort of, you know, health warnings. It's just normal to do that until they're one, two, even older.
And Bridges, we have a break coming up, but you wanted to weigh in on that.
Oh, I did. The whole idea of anxiety, there's a lot of looking at why did the sense of anxiety rise? Why do we have helicopter parenting? You know, why are we so invested in our kids to the point of madness sometimes? And it's very interesting. There are some theories that really tie it to what's happening structurally in the economy. When you look at in the 1970s, what started to happen was wage stagnation. You started to have a real division where manufacturing jobs disappeared. You didn't have an assured middle class life with only a high school degree. And so thus upped the ante that you had to get a college degree to have as good or better a life as your parents. And that there's some theories that that's where some of the anxiety really comes from.
Bridget, we'll talk more about that point in a moment. We have to take a short break. We're talking about parenting and parenting advice on Radio Times with two great authors today. We'll talk more after our break. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious or depressed? Had mood swings or been diagnosed with bipolar disorder? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is researching better treatment for bipolar disorder, anxiety, and depression. You may be eligible for a research study of the effects of medications or natural supplements to treat these symptoms. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for participation. To learn more, 215-662-3462, 215-662-3462.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Newsweek's Paris Bureau Chief Christopher Dickey will be with us to talk about how the Toulouse story is shaking France. Also, after a year and a half hiatus, those scotch-swigging, cigarette-smoking madmen of Madison Avenue are back. Are they worth the wait? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Walnut Street Theater brings you the Philadelphia premiere of the Tony Award-winning best play, God of Carnage, a comedy of manners without the manners. Two children get into a fight and one gets hurt. The boy's parents meet to discuss the matter in a civilized manner. However, as the evening goes on, the parents become increasingly childish, resulting in unmannered chaos. The internationally acclaimed comedy God of Carnage, now through April 29th. Details at walnutstreettheater.org, Ticketmaster, or 215-574-3550.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscoane. We're talking about parenting and parenting advice with journalist Bridget Schulte and author Mailing Hopgood. She has written a book, How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm. Let's go right to the phones. We have Georgia joining us from Cherry Hill. Hello, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just want to say this is a great topic. I could talk about it all day long. I have two things I wanted to say. I was 40 years old when I adopted my daughter from China, and it was a very difficult adjustment for me. And one of the things that caused me such stress and anxiety was the sleeping issues. I was relying on a book that was recommended by my sister-in-law that said, you know, the child should really go to sleep at 7 o'clock and you should keep them on this rigid schedule. And I remember I was putting such pressure on myself. It wasn't working, and I had such anxiety. And then it dawned on me one day just to go get a different book.
That's right.
I said, why am I putting such pressure on myself? So I went to the library. I got another book that was much more relaxed, that they said, don't worry about when they go to bed and if they have to nap in the car or nap here, you know, it's okay. You're not a bad mother. And the important thing is that you get your sleep and your child get your sleep and you do whatever you have to do to get the sleep.
And then how did things work
wonderful.
Out?
So my advice to people is just go get a different book. If the one that you're relying on makes you feel bad. And my second point is just another book that was so helpful to me and really saved my sanity was this book called I Was a Good Mother Before I Had Kids. And it's written by these
great.
Two women, and they basically talk about, again, don't put so much pressure on yourself. And they have little blurbs in there from a variety of parents talking about their dirty secrets and saying, you know, the things that they do as parents that they view as being bad parents, but it just takes the pressure off.
Thank you so much. That's a great
comment. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for that call. Bridget?
I have one of those dirty little secrets to confess.
What's that?
Well, this is where, you know, going out and getting another book or just throwing books out altogether is such great advice. You know, there's so much out there that can make you feel badly. You can't do all of those things. But when my son was little, he loved his pacifier. He just, you know, he learned how to talk through the pacifier. He just never, ever had that thing out of his mouth. And I remember being very worried. And talking to the preschool director, who was a lovely person and a good friend, and I remember telling her, she just told it like it was, and she loved the kids. She was very kid focused, and I remember just kind of talking to her in the parking lot, confessing, "Oh, this is so terrible," and he's almost four, and he's got a pacifier, and this is just so awful. And she looked at me with such disdain, and she said, you know, we have our booze, and we have our cigarettes. We have all these things to soothe us, and you're going to worry about one little two-inch piece of rubber? You know? She's like, you know what? He won't use it when he doesn't need it.
That's a nice...
End of story.
Yeah, yeah. Mailing, anything to add on the issue of good advice and sometimes just...
Well, I mean, and just as sort of an overall, after doing this investigation and for my book, you know, the end feeling that I got, the biggest lesson that I personally came away with, that actually, you know, there's a million ways in the world to raise a happy and healthy child. I mean, so the vast differences in how people discipline, how they sleep their kids, how they feed them. You know, there are certainly universals in how much sleep in terms of hours we need to be healthy, how much we need to get to eat, how much, you know, in terms of, you know, you need nurture, you need level, different levels of, you know, you need a certain amount of essentials. But the way you do it can be different. And so many of the families I talked to did things so differently from what we would think is the way we have to do things, that I really came away with this feeling of, you know, there are just a lot of ways to be a good parent in the world. And we just have to choose the ones that work for us.
And our kids, probably. Let's take another call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Amy joining us from Philadelphia. Hi, Amy. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Mike, and it's nice to hear you, and I love the topic.
Thank you.
I'm a new mom, and I was wondering if the sort of, you know, these moms sort of band into these, you know, attachment parenting versus Dr. Ferber versus, you know, China, France, Zimbabwe, whatever it is that's popular, and I wonder if the animosity that's created is just sort of part of the way that our overall, in America at least, culture is going, where everyone just says, you know, they think that they're right all of the time, like, i.e. the political discourse in the country right now, and it's okay to just outwardly, you know, be open in judging people and just be out there like that.
Amy, that's a great point. Again, we're going to take your line down just because it's breaking up a little bit. But Mei-Ling, do you think there is a point to that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great point that I hadn't really thought about. I mean, we do. We get up there and we comment on everything in our culture. So it's certainly true.
But is it also, Bridget, maybe a way to appease that anxiety we've been talking about? Because if we do feel anxious and then we find other moms who are doing things the way we're doing, or other parents who are doing things the way we're doing them, does it make us feel less anxious? And then maybe we can say, well, the other people are doing it wrong.
I don't know if it makes us feel less anxious, but it is a really worrying thing. She's really put her finger on it. You know, if you go to any like a DC Urban Moms or a Listserv or any kind of these mom sites that most of the major cities have, the level of discourse, the tone is so nasty. It's really, really disturbing when you think about something that is so lovely, raising a child, and there's so many different ways to do it, and there's no really wrong way other than neglecting and not loving your child. There's so many ways to love a child. There's so many ways to raise a happy and healthy child. And I don't know if it's the internet culture, if there's something about having anonymous comments where you can just flame off. But I think that I think it increases the anxiety and the animosity. I don't think it makes anything better.
And do you think you see that anxiety sometimes when you see a mother struggling with a child in a public place, and it's almost like the anxiety, how she is being viewed by others, is oozing from every pore of her body? And I'm sure we've all felt that as parents, that we're being judged when we're not maybe handling a situation well or something is not going right.
Well, I know that there's certainly that feeling out there, but I guess what I try to do now when I see a kid having a breakdown, and instead of immediately thinking, oh, they need a nap, they shouldn't be out here, just remembering that there were plenty of times that I was in that situation and trying to at least smile or, you know.
And Mei-Ling, when you were living in Argentina, did you feel like people were more forgiving of whatever was going on at that moment?
Oh, absolutely. And they would jump right in. I mean, you know, your kid would be having a meltdown and the waiter or the owner of the restaurant would come take him and take him into the kitchen. I mean, it was just that they would do things that would be never, you know, permitted in terms of even, and so many levels. And I just remember one time I was really struggling. I took my two girls out for a walk and the stroller wasn't correct, and it was just collapsing on me, and I was trying to pull the stroller into place and have the baby in my hand, and this young man, you know, with tattoos all over his arm, and he was cleaning off the sidewalk, he's like, I'll take the baby, and no problem, and he's playing with her as I'm fixing the stroller. I mean, it's just much of a, it's sort of like people jump in to help you, and they don't feel like they're imposing, and crossing any lines, because that's how that culture is.
And they're also not getting arrested immediately.
Right, right. I mean, it's not something bad that they would get involved. It's assumed that it's very much more. It's allowed in that culture. It's expected that people would be interested in your child and helping you, or even just, you know, just in your face sometimes about your children. And I remember some of the American moms that I hung out with were a little uncomfortable with it at times, because they, you know, when an older man is touching your baby, and not in a bad way, but, you know, paying so much attention, it brings up all your own views and biases about who should be close to a child.
And stranger
and
danger.
Right.
Let's take another call at 1-888-477-9499. We have Christina joining us from Worstown. Hi, Christina. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up different parenting styles between the genders. I'm a mother of two sons, and one's 14, and he's very high-functioning autism, but he's going into high school next year, and we have had him mainstreamed as much as possible, and you'd never know it to meet him that there was anything wrong, and mostly it's just social nowadays. But my husband, who, he hasn't been very involved that much. I mean, for the first, I'd say, 8 years or so of his life, I was basically the main parent. My husband was working, trying to get things together and stuff. But now suddenly he's going into crazy hyperdrive, because he's like, oh my God, his GPA, he has to bring it up. Does he even know what that means? And, oh, you know, and we've been fighting, and it's just crazy. And all because high school, because Morristown is like, you know, a very, I don't know, 10 years ago or 20, 15 years ago, they said, oh, it's the greatest town in America. So now everybody still believes that for some reason here. But anyway, he's been going into hyperdrive about, you know, he has to get into the STARS program, and, you know, is he going to be playing any other kind of sports? And because they're not very athletic. My second son is 10, and he's just kind of taking it all in, and I don't know.
Thank you so much for that call, Christina. You bring up a very interesting point that we haven't really talked about so far. Bridget, what's your take? Who is driving in terms of parenting philosophy? Is it still mothers? Is it fathers? Is there a lot of conflict in households over, you know, how children should be raised?
Well, it's interesting, and hopefully it's changing. You know, when you look at the history of parenting, it's really interesting. In the medieval times, babies were considered like devils, you know, and it was sort of not a big deal to send them off to the wet nurse because you just wanted to get them out of your hair. And then over time in the Victorian era, it was seen as something that was so important that really only fathers could tell you, sort of set the tone and set the strategy. The mothers implemented it, but the fathers decided what should be done. And it's really been a change in the last century that it became very much the mother's territory, that the mother's responsibility, the mother's territory. And it's beginning to change with fathers becoming more involved, which I think is a good thing, that it's becoming more of a parent's decision. But it sounds like what the caller is talking about really goes back to everything that we've been talking about, that anxiety about the future. And it really does hit about high school. Oh, my God, what is my child going to do when they grow up? And, oh, my God, are they ready, and are they going to have a better life? And there's just an awful lot of anxiety and fear around that.
Mei-Ling.
One of the things I was going to bring up, that one of the chapters I wrote about, is sort of the Asian academic drive, and you'll see that in other cultures as well. It manifests itself differently, but definitely there is a lot of pressure in Asian cultures to achieve as well, because not only is it here, it's more of an individual thing. How is the child going to do? How are they going to form a life in this world, whereas in cultures such as India or Korea or China,
it is also the family. How is that family going to move up because this child is because of their achievement? So, I mean, I was just reflecting on other cultures. It's very much the case in Asian cultures as well.
And Mei Ling, what did you see in your research about the roles of fathers, of mothers, of decision making in terms of parenting philosophy?
Overall, you know, the researchers say that in almost every culture, the mother still has much more of an influence, on, at least domestically with children and the care of children. I mean, that's without a doubt. I mean, I wrote and focused on a pygmy tribe, the Akka, who are the Fatherhood Institute voted as the best fathers in the world, and they had 47% of took care of 47% of the child care. So they weren't quite even up to 50%, and they were considered the best. But that said, and especially in Western cultures, fathers are much more involved. Over and over again, researchers talked about that. So it's not that men are not stepping up. They're stepping up a lot more, but that they still don't. They still are not as involved as mothers by far.
And we only have a short moment before we have to go, unfortunately. Mei Ling, what is the best advice that you have found, the one piece that you would pass on to other people and feel really good about?
Well, I mean, and that goes back to what we've been talking about, that, you know, relax. Kids turn out okay. You know, the challenges that we're facing are natural challenges of parenthood, and we don't need to beat ourselves up because, I mean, I guess when you have more than one kid, you also learn this because you go through it with the first one, and then when you go through it with the second one, you're like, oh, yeah, this will pass. You know, one day I will kind of sleep. I mean, you kind of take it in a different way the second time around. I think that was a key lesson for me, to see all these different ways that parents were doing things and how they believed or played with their children, did not play with their children, they trained earlier, they did not. The kids generally turned out well. It goes back to, you know, love and basic care and you know, and you give them a thriving beginning, and they will find their way.
And Bridget, just about 30 seconds left. What's your take? What's the best piece of advice you've been given or have found?
Well, I think it's that very same thing, that sense of take a deep breath, relax, trust yourself, spend the time, the quality time, to get to know what it is your child needs and give them that.
And with that, we have to go. Thank you so much to both of you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Bridget Schulte is a staff writer for The Washington Post. She's been there since 1999. She's currently on leave and is a fellow at the New America Foundation and is writing a book. Mei Ling Hopgood is a professor of journalism at Northwestern University, and her new book is How Eskimos Keep Their Babies Warm and Other Adventures in Parenting. You've been listening to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain.